And good morning and welcome to this December 21st, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. It's the Christmas season and we are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Stitcher. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It is my pleasure to welcome Fanny Flagg and Odie Lindsay to the show this morning. Fanny is on with me now, and I'll play an interview that I pre-recorded yesterday with Odie in the second half of the show. But first, Fanny, at age 19, she began writing and producing television specials and later wrote and appeared on Candid Camera. She then went on to distinguish herself as an actress and a writer in television, films, and the theater. She is a New York Times best-selling author of Daisy Fay and The Miracle Man, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, Welcome to the World, Baby Girl, Standing in the Rainbow, A Red Bird Christmas, and Can't Wait to Get to Heaven. Her script for the movie Fried Green Tomatoes was nominated for an Academy Award and the Writers Guild of America Award and won the highly regarded Scripter Award for Best Screenplay of the Year. She joins me this morning to talk about her latest novel, The Whole Town's Talking. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Fanny, welcome.
Well, good morning. I'm just thrilled to be on with you today, and I just want to tell you that I just love Orange County and Irvine.
Me too.
It's so beautiful. I just got back from a book tour, and it was on the East Coast, and I'll tell you what, I was so happy when that plane landed in L.A.
It's a little warmer here.
Yes, well, it is. It is.
And I hear you're coming back because you're going to be here for Literary Orange, I think, in April, yeah?
I am. And, you know, this is the second time I've done it, and it's in April, I think. And I'm looking so forward to it. I really am.
Me too. Well, a lot of our listeners are big attendees. Barbara and I are both big attendees. So we'll get to meet in person.
Yay!
And, and share a little cup of tea.
Thank you. I love it. I love it.
Me too. So this novel is such a good anecdote to all of my current woes in life. It was so nice to be transported to a different time, a different place.
A different place. Well, I appreciate that because, honestly, this is what I wanted to do. I just felt that I wanted to write a book that would be fun and uplifting and not dark and depressing, you know, because when I'm writing, honey, I have to keep myself, in a good mood. So I have to say, I feel guilty because I sit in my little room all by myself and I just laugh. And because I used, as you said earlier, I used to work for Candid Camera, I just find people hilarious. So as much as I would love to be, write serious, dark novels, I just can't do it.
It's not in you. I love it.
No.
Well, no. This was great. This was so, like I say, so transportative, so fun. It was just nice to turn off the news for, 10
Absolutely.
Hours and immerse myself in this world. It was great. So I'm going to let you talk about it. And okay. For our listeners who haven't yet picked it up,
right.
Shame on you. And
you're so sweet. Well, let me tell you, I started out to write, I wanted to write a story about a small town America and immigrants. And strangely enough, it just immigration and immigrants just happened to be timely, which is hilarious for me because I'm never timely. But anyhow, this is the story of a little town in Missouri called Elmwood Springs, and I have written about it before. So, Mari, I'd have to say that this is a prequel to some of the books I've written because I bring back some of the same characters. And it starts in the 1800s and with a Swedish immigrant named Lars Nordström who comes from over from Sweden and comes to this territory in Missouri. And he buys some land, and then he advertises for more Swedish immigrants to join him. And from that, they create this little town of Elmwood Springs. And the book goes from the 1800s, and we follow the little town and its residents up into the future, which is kind of brave of me. I go into the 2025, so I hope I'm right. And I bring back some of the characters, like I say, that I loved. And one of the reasons I did write, brought those characters back is I just fell in love with them. And you know, as you and I know, you start in a certain age, you start losing loved ones, and you just hate to say goodbye. And I kind of felt the same way with those characters. I just hated to say goodbye to them. So the mystery of the book or the is that I don't really say goodbye.
Right.
They just keep going, which is what I hope you and I will do.
Me too. That
Me
was
too.
Very comforting.
Thank you, darling. And, of course, my one of my favorite characters, and they always, you know, I always go, this is who I'd like to be when I grow up, is my favorite character is Eleanor Shemfizzle, who is this older farm lady who lives out on the farm and has all these cats and chickens and raccoons, and she just cracks me up. So I just get the biggest kick out of her, and she's very sweet and very kind, and I just like to be her when I grow up.
Me too. Yeah, I mean, it was such a heavily populated novel that I wonder how you keep that all straight. Like, what does your office look like to keep track of this town and all of the people in it and their own little character trajectories and all that?
Well, I would be so embarrassed if you would come to see my office. It looks like it's been robbed. Well, I will tell you, I'm sure, I don't know if you know this or not, but I am very seriously dyslexic.
Yeah.
So what I do, which is, I'm sure other writers don't do this, but sometimes I'll write the end of a book before I write the beginning. And then I'll write the middle, and then I'll go back and write something in the beginning.
Wow.
And so all of these characters, keeping them straight in my head, I don't know how I do it, frankly. Yeah. And at the end, when I'm finished the book, I've got all these chapters. I write in very small chapters, and I do that for the reader because I know that my attention span has become shorter and shorter, and I think it's because of the internet and television and all that. So I write in very short chapters, to give you a chance to put the book down and you know, come back to it at any time.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, you could pick up any of my books and start at the middle and go back, and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah,
the
right.
way I write.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have to sort of make a list for myself of all my characters, and when I think I've finished, the hardest part for me is to put the book in order that I think is the correct order, where it would read, where the mysteries happen when they're supposed to, and so that's the hard part for me. And these characters seem very real to me, so they're like friends. So I kind of have a better visual picture of them, maybe than readers do. So it's easy for me to kind of keep track of my characters.
So all of this is in your brain, really?
It's in my brain,
wow.
and it's pretty tragic.
I love it. I wish my brain worked like that. And then, you know, I mean, for the structure of it, because it's told through time and through decades and broken down by the decades, you know, that's a nice structure, I think, for both writer and reader to be able
yes.
to
and that
follow.
Kind of helped me, too.
Yeah.
That kind of helped me to, you know, go through each decade. And I obviously had to do an awful lot of research for this book.
Yeah, right.
And I love to do research because I learned so much that I didn't know. And the thing that I was so impressed with, that's why the book became much larger than what I wanted, but oh well, I became absolutely fascinated with the plight of the immigrant, and it dawned on me something that was so uplifting and so, made me so happy and so proud, is that I realized that you and I, no matter where our ancestors came from, you know, came from very sturdy stock, because in order to just survive the trip over from, you know, to get here, you had to be physically strong, yeah. Number one, because it was a killing trip. Number two, you had to be a real adventurous dreamer, kind of a person, to absolutely leave your homeland and put all your dreams and hopes into a place you've never been. So you had to be, you know, a combination of strong and have dreams of doing better. And I thought, no wonder, you know, America was such a success, because we really, people that left their homeland to come here, that was took a special person, and we are all descended from those people. So I thought, good for us, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
It is. It's an amazing, the immigrant story is an amazing story. It continues to be an amazing story throughout time.
It does. Yeah. It does. And, you know, we continue to just grow, and different peoples come in and all of that. And I, in this book, as you know, I focused on a Swedish immigrant, because, and I don't know if you've ever done this. Have you ever had your DNA done?
I have. It's really fun.
Oh, my God. Were you surprised?
Yeah, it's really fun.
Wasn't it fun?
I was surprised I wasn't Native American. I really wanted to be Native American. I'm not. I'm so angry.
You did. Well, I knew that I was a little French, a little English, a little Welsh. You know how the combination we all are, sort of. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I did this. A friend of mine, who's just a darling girl in L.A., sent me this DNA thing for Christmas. And so I had it done, and I got on the Internet, and I couldn't believe it. Because it said, how they say your genome is?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It said, this genome is very rare, and the ancestry goes straight back to, and I was going, oh, no, where? Finland.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I was never so surprised in my life, because I had no idea that I was Swedish or any, you know, that Scandinavian thing, but I've always been drawn to all things Swedish, and when I was a child growing up in Alabama, I used to fantasize about the land of the midnight sun and the reindeer.
Oh, my God.
Well, yeah, and snow. Oh. And I thought, I wonder, you know, it's made me wonder about if our DNA is not stronger than what we think.
Yeah.
So I was just tickled pink that I was, you know, and here I was writing about Swedes.
That is so funny.
Isn't it hilarious?
It's like your memory is encoded in your DNA, sort
yes.
of. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yes.
And I enjoyed watching, you know, the budding relationship between Lorder and Katrina at the beginning.
Yes.
You know, it was like the earliest form of Internet dating or something.
Isn't it the truth? Well, you know, when I was doing my research about the immigrants and all that, I read about the mail order brides, which I had known a little bit about, but I hadn't really studied about it. And I got tickled, because I was thinking to myself, you know, times change, but human nature does not. And what I found out is the mail order brides would send their picture to the farmer, and the farmer would send his picture. And just like online dating, you know, they would send a picture that was taken 20 years earlier,
right.
And or the woman would send a picture back when she was 40 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
And so sometimes these poor women would get off the train, you know, having come from across the country, and this guy standing there wasn't anything like the picture she had. So that's kind of made me laugh, because times do change, but, you know, human nature really doesn't change much.
Isn't that true? And that was really the fun part of this book also, was watching, you know, the sweep of time. As you say, it starts in 1890 and goes mm-hmm. to 2020 or 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And you really can see all the patterns of not only human nature, but mm-hmm. history and, you know, what our country's been through. And
mm-hmm.
it's nice at this point in our country's life
mm-hmm.
to see what this country has endured in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And And it, the whole novel was just very comforting.
Well, thank you. That's what I had hoped to do. And I had also hoped to kind of remind myself and remind the world that there's an awful lot of nice people in this country that get up every day and go to work and, you know, aren't mad and complaining about everything. They're just decent people, and they kind of never get much press.
Yeah, exactly right.
You know, and I like to give them good press because there's a lot of them, and when you visit hospitals to see friends and all that, you see these doctors and nurses that are so devoted, and you go to schools and see these teachers, and you go, gosh, you know, those people just never get much attention. They don't get the big salaries like the football players and the basketball players and the movie stars, but they're awful good people, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And an awful good parts of the country that often go overlooked by the, you know, I mean, I think the coasts tend to read a lot about, we know everything about New York and L.A., but Elmwood Springs, Missouri, we didn't know as much about, and it's great. It's great.
Well, thank you, darling. And I picked Missouri because I don't know much about geography. I got it kind of wrong. I thought that was like the center of the country, and I forgot about New Mexico and Arizona, so you'll forgive me.
It's easy to do. My guest this morning is Fannie Flagg. The book, The Whole Town's Talking, is what we are talking about on Writers on Writing, KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So it seems like the afterlife is a little on your mind.
Yeah.
And a comforting afterlife, as we were saying it is. And so I was just wondering what you think about that. And as you've been writing over the decades, you know, what things have become more interesting to you now as you've gotten older than were maybe 50 years ago? What you write about now as you change, as you grow as a writer?
Yes. Well, that's a very good question. And it's true. I realize that as, you know, I am in my 70s and I just sort of like have started losing friends and, of course, family members and all of that. And it changes your perspective about life and what's important. When I was younger, you know, I used to just be so, oh, gosh, obsessed with, oh, what did people think? Did I say the right thing and did I do the right thing? And spending a lot of time with people that I didn't care about, but, you know, I don't know, but as you get older, your priorities change, and you really sort of start to focus on what's really important in life. And what I have come to believe, and, you know, through just living, really what's important is life and death, and that the stuff in between, a lot of it's not that important that we think, you know, about, and our friendships and people that we love, being around them, is much more important than what it used to be to me. And spending time developing friendships, and it's just a different way of looking at life. And I have to say, I don't know about you're probably so much younger than I am, but I have to say that I am much happier as an older person than I was as a younger person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was not a very happy younger person. I was very kind of nervous and driven and wanting to succeed and please everybody, you know.
Yep.
And I still want to please everybody, but it just doesn't absolutely kill me because I realize that you can't.
Right, right. Yeah,
that takes age.
I was going to say, it's such a shame that we learn all of these things later when we can't apply. I mean, you know, you can tell the young, but you can't apply it the same way. You've just got to go through it, which is...
That's just exactly right.
Which is such a shame. And
it is.
Oh, well. And all these great lessons for women. You know, I always love your women, and I love Southern women. I've never spent any time at all in the South or in Missouri.
Well, you should come. They'd love you.
Should. I wish I should come. But I really enjoy that dichotomy of really strong women, but very traditional, you know, and the women in here, you know, going through the women's suffrage movement and seeing, you know, how resilient and engaged and but still, you know, feminine, and all the trials these women went through were just
right.
You're great with women.
Well, thank you. I had very good, strong female role models. My grandmother was of course just very a big influence on me, and my mother, and you know, I'm with you. I think that people don't understand how strong those women that settled this country were. People always say the pioneers and their wives. Well, no, it was the wives were pioneers as well,
right?
And worked as hard and had as much authority. You know, some of these women, when their husbands died, ran these farms, ran these ranches, and they really were the first liberated women. And as my little immigrant Swedish woman writes to the mail order bride, she said, "This we are American women. The men do not rule with an iron hand here, like in Sweden. We are free American women." And so those Western women and those Midwestern women and Southern women, they were very strong and yet retained a sense of femininity in its best form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So good. I want to spend a couple of minutes on crafty questions because a lot of our listeners are writers themselves. And I'm just fascinated by your ability to write these sweeping, wonderful novels. And as you mentioned earlier, to battle with dyslexia and kind of how that... And it sounds like you have just an incredible memory that, you know, has served you well to hold all of this in your head.
Thank you.
But maybe we could just talk about your revision process, you know, how you get this down and then how you work with it.
Yes, yes. Well, in this particular book, I envisioned the last scene, which we won't give away, but I write visually. I see things, you know, and my last visual that started this book was to a crow and a dove in a tree speaking. From that came this book. And so I get visuals, pictures of just scenes. I did a lot of theater work, so I kind of write. I continue. If you'll notice, I don't say chapters. I say scenes,
yep.
Which is not correct. It should be chapters, but I continue to say scenes, and I visually see them and I hear them talking, and I almost think that it's. For me, my dad and my grandfather were both motion picture machine operators, so I grew up in the movies. So I think that because I'm dyslexic, that I visually see these scenes and hear them talking, and I think possibly because I had to listen so very hard to get my lessons in school, that I'm much more attuned to people's dialogue. So I find that I am really best at dialogue because I read other people's books and they are just their descriptions are so beautiful and lovely and all of that, and I'm just in awe of that. But I think that my best part is dialogue because I love the way real people speak.
It's funny you should say that because this really, I was going to ask you about the connection between acting and writing because it does read, it's so visual and you're right, your dialogue is so great. And I thought, you know, the actress in you seeps into these pages, I think, that you you make us see it. And you wrote the screenplay for Fried Green Tomatoes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it really comes through that your dialogue is spot on. I struggle with dialogue so much. It's just so hard for me to make people sound different and yet authentic to who they are and yet, you know, not boring.
it's a hard thing, but I just was lucky enough. You know how they say that you can take a disability and turn it in your favor, and I think that I got lucky in that by having to listen, like I said, I'm really very sensitive to the way people really speak. And I think the mistake that a lot of my young writers that I work with, they will write dialogue and think that it has to be literary.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't. It really has to be exactly as people speak.
Right,
you know?
Right. How many passes did you take through this book in revision?
Honey, I would say at least five.
Wow.
Or six. Wow. And, of course, you eliminate. Well, I do. I eliminate a lot. I rework. And with me, because I'm always, you know, changing the order of the chapters, then I have to go back and sometimes fix something that doesn't work the way I thought it would. And so it's a long, for me, hard process. And the other hard part about it is because of my situation that I'm so easily distracted, I have to be all by myself in a room with no phone, no fax. I can't have any kind of distractions, because if I see a leaf fall off a tree, I'm gone for 2 hours, and I get very lonely. I get very lonesome. And so once I finish a book and get out on a book tour and get out to meet people, I'm just as happy as I can be. Most writers don't like that. I can't wait to get out, because I miss people, you know, because I love them, then they make me laugh. And so I just, that's the hardest part of writing for me, is the revisions and having to be by myself.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait for you to get out here.
Me either.
So looking forward to having you out in April. Any last minute words of advice for writers?
Well, this is all what I always say. Most of my little writers get so worried. They say, oh, I don't know if I'm a writer or not. I don't know if I'm a writer or not. And the good news for all of us is, if you are a writer, you will not be able to not write. So don't worry about it.
That's exactly right. You know, the people that I know who were really dedicated to this, I mean, the people who could take it or leave it tend to drop off fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and believe me, of all the professions that I should have chosen, writing was not one, but it was something that I could not do.
Well, and, you know, through all of the things that you've done in life, I always wondered, and I think I know the answer, of what gave you the most satisfaction. And you've accomplished so much, and you've been in so many different arenas, but it really sounds like writing was your first calling, your first lover.
Maury, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I love
it. And that's what I always wanted to be, but I got waylaid by acting, and I was really not personality set for that. I was much more wanting to observe than to be observed.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Well, this was a huge pleasure. I look forward to seeing you at Literary Orange, and I love following all of your adventures online. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to see you.
Me too.
Okay, honey.
We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Odie Lindsay will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads of hundreds and hundreds of shows, as well as speaker series events. There's some incredible ones coming up in January and February. Who's coming up on our show? You can also follow us on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM and Stitcher, Facebook. We're all over the place. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. I'm going to play an interview that I did with Odie Lindsay yesterday. I'm going to start that up now. And he was a delight, so stay tuned for that. Odie Lindsay's stories have appeared in Best American Short Stories, The Iowa Review, Columbia, and the anthology 40 Stories, among others. His first collection is out now. It is We Come to Our Senses. It's published by Norton. Odie is a veteran. He lives in Nashville, Tennessee, although he joins us from the road this morning. Odie, welcome.
Hi, great to be with you.
Thank you for this. You know, it's ironic that we're chatting from the road, or maybe it isn't ironic, but it sounds like the road is sort of where you're most comfortable, and, you know, you sound like a man on the move.
Yeah, I tend to like to hit the road a bit. It's funny, I'm actually in Birmingham, Alabama, in a parking lot, which is where I used to come as a kid. I grew up, my grandparents were from here. They're no longer around, so it's been a while. But it seemed like a fun stop, and I'm outside of a bookshop that that my granddad would take me to now and again when I was a kid. So, a good place to stop.
I love it. I love it. And we'll get into this later in the interview, but it just strikes me that all of your moving and relocation is such a great feeder for being a writer. The sense of place and all that stuff is, good fodder for writing.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I think I'm so attracted to sort of the slighter, more everyday sort of cultural details or tics. So just being someplace new always, it burns so bright in terms of the fodder that's there and the way that people are the same or different. And whether that's been in Tangiers, Morocco or Oxford, Mississippi, I just love it. I just love it.
Great. So let's get into, I'll introduce the collection. I'll let you introduce the collection. A lot of these stories, so there's 15 stories, and I think like five of them have appeared individually in literary journals. But I know, you know, putting together a collection is kind of a different animal, and the stories have to, you know, cohere as, not as individual stories, but also as a collection. So talk a little bit about putting this together and some of the overarching themes, and just kind of take us into the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if there were two themes that I think undergird the stories, one are based sort of on my veteran experience. I wanted to look at the South, and I wanted to look at the culture that sort of, in particular, militarizes masculinity to some extent. And that's not unique to the South, but I think there are unique ways that the South does that. And I thought, you know, what is it about that experiences or this identity that are intertwined? And then the second thing was I wanted to try and tell stories that I think are ridiculously underrepresented, and in this case, stories of female veterans, of queer veterans, folks that I served alongside, but who, just aren't represented. Their war stories aren't a part of the narrative. So I guess long answer, longer, I served in Desert Storm in 1991, and I never wrote about it. I didn't even know how to start to process that, and nor did colleagues who I served with. And then in 2003, when this new war opened up, there was a tsunami of emotion about it, and that's when I really started thinking about switching from writing about other things I'd been involved with to writing about war. But I thought, I don't want a boots on the ground story. I don't want this sort of acute, over the top air or trauma. I want more of the everyday, so it kind of spun from there. Some of the stories were new. Some of the stories have been around just waiting. They were sketches, and only when I came at them sort of with this new lens did they fully develop. But again, I think a big uniter was this idea of time.
Uh-huh.
This 12-year separation, while this we had the same forces going to the same place, combative, same person, and the president had the same last name. And I thought, wow, I've got to dive into that rotation. It's terrifying, and it's horrifying, and it's just so strange. So that's sort of how this started.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, and from there, really, it was more about, again, trying to tell stories almost that were as much about home or about being home as they were certainly about being about the actual deployment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I had read some reviewer talk, and I hadn't really thought about it this way before, but talk about war is not really a time and a place or one single event, but it's really, you've really kind of redefined what war is, which is something that reoccurs for, you know, the rest of a soldier's lifetime, you know, that it kind of is haunting. And I thought, actually, there are three stories in this where this woman, Darla, makes an appearance, and I kind of want to talk about her a little later, too, because I loved her. But she's got this disease, and I was thinking that disease really mirrors war well, that, you know, it's something that, you know, there's a singular event, and then you're strapped with this monkey on your back for the rest of your life that rears its head in different ways. And, you know, it might go dormant for a while and it might pop up when you least expect it, but it's always inside you. And I thought she and her disease worked as such a great metaphor for war throughout this book.
Well, thanks. And yeah, that's another thing. Even with the passing of time was this notion, yeah, we tend to fixate events or trauma in terms of being fixed to time, right? This happened then, and then it was done. And we all know, whether it was getting your heart broken or a car crash or, in this case, war, I mean, trauma and or vulnerability lingers. And so there were a couple stories there, or a couple of things that went into the Darla stories. And one was this notion of time and vulnerability and trauma that continues. The other, very practically, was that she only tangentially interacts with a soldier, and I wanted to pull that thread of connection as far as I could. And we don't even see her with the soldier in any of these stories, and I thought that this has impacted her life. And yeah, that was a vehicle for me to discuss that. But I think that was also the anguish that I was considering when I saw this new generation be deployed in 2003. Incredible that it was that long. I thought, there's such a humor to think that folks are going to come back, and then it's done, and it's not done, and it won't be for an extraordinary amount of time for a vast majority of these people. So that's the push, and I thought that, yeah, the vehicle of health or a chronic illness and the way that could play out was another way to address the longevity of the condition.
Yeah, so good, so good. So let's talk about Darla. She's one of the only, I think, kind of recurring, well, no, I guess she's not one of the only recurring characters because she recurs with the other characters. But tell me a little bit about her, what motivated her, if she was a character who was hard to get right or if she kind of came easily to you, and what it was about her that, you know, kind of kept her on the brain a little bit, and kind of give us a window into mining her character.
Sure, absolutely. Well, she, two things behind the Darla stories, and it's funny, they're all set in Mississippi, and one thing I found, I lived in Oxford, I worked with Barry Hanna down there, and I did graduate work, cultural studies work down there, and one thing I found is that I really loved it, and if I wrote sort of a love letter to Mississippi, or really a love letter anywhere I've lived, it sort of fell flat. And so one thing about the stories was I needed a narrator, or I needed this condition where the person was almost griping about their location. That seemed to have more energy. In Darla's case, she's from Mississippi, so I said, okay, I can't write from her perspective. I'm really invested in her, but I needed her partner to be the one that tells the story because she has a complicated relationship to the space, and it's a complicated space for sure. But I wanted a little bit of removal just to let her exist. and let the person tell their story, really not like the space. But the second thing was sort of inspired by real life. I had a partner for a while who's HIV positive, and when you initially, at least in my experience, begin a relationship with someone, it's like a neon billboard. Here's this condition. Here's this condition. Here's everything you can bring to it, culturally or otherwise, that might affect the relationship itself. But at the end of the day, the smaller things are what sort of kicks your ass. Forgive me. And were things that would translate to any relationship, only writ differently or writ with different tensions. And for Darla, I wanted to import that sort of thing, a chronic condition, and the things that bother or get in the way of her partner, herself, are the fact that her pills won't stay down, or she needs to eat with her pills, and he doesn't feel like eating, and there's this grumble, or there's the judgment of her condition, or there's wanting to go out of town to pick up a prescription, because when you're in a small town anywhere, I would assume, you know, people, they gossip. It's harder to be anonymous. So those are the things that really wanted to funnel into Darla. And again, just being sort of tangentially related to war, there's this notion that 1% of us have an immediate family member who's deployed to war. And I thought, well, I want to bring that closer to home. And how can I do it? I can do it with a character who has this chronic illness. She's only met a soldier, but that soldier has sort of dictated the rest of her life and her consequent relationships.
So good. So good. I noticed that 14 of the 15 stories are told in first person. I think every story except Colleen, I think, is in first person, which gave it, you know, just this really close, immediate feeling. I find it so hard to write in first person, and I love being in it because, you know, you just feel like you have so much access to these people. So tell me a little bit about whether that was a conscious decision, if they just kind of came out as first person, or if that allowed you kind of, you know, closer access to these people, or, and then for Colleen's character, you know, why you stepped back into third.
Sure, absolutely. I think for me, I mean, the perhaps the hardest thing about figuring out how to put a sentence together was one that I needed to accept that about 98% of what I wrote was going to not make the cut. And that even involves sometimes taking a story that's a first person, throwing it into third, looking at the two, figuring out what works best process-wise. That was the case with some of these. But the other part of the experiment for me was I didn't want to risk sort of a unified approach to this idea of war or culture. I did want to critique it, for sure, but I just don't like narratives that are that clean in terms of putting a bow on things to a great extent. So I thought in order to complicate that, I wanted to have a series of first-person characters. They're from different realms. Some of them are snug in their post-war suburban environments, watching television. Some of them, like Darla, are only tangentially connected to war. Some of them are in this sort of horrific space. But for me, the first-person decision allowed me to give a comprehensive take on various experiences that all were in dialogue, that all experienced things a little bit differently. And I think threading that needle was important. It did feel closer. It did feel more intimate, going first person. I have a guy in a sort of flop house apartment in Chicago. I wanted him to narrate his space. I also, tonally or even in terms of the writing itself, I wanted to mix it up a little bit stylistically. And it seemed to me that the first person thing allowed me to do that as well. So those were the decisions. And then the final thing, I think, for me, in terms of trying to import one's own experience into that process, it was easier. Well, I learned that my own story actually had ridiculously little to do with any of this. What I thought was, well, if I can
populate some of these stories with the specifics from my experience. If I see a camel on the side of the road and it's been hit by a tank, forgive me, that sounds horrible, that will lend authenticity to a first-person voice in this case more than maybe a third person. If that makes sense. It's hard to, I'll be quiet. It just worked well. It worked well, again, to give a comprehensive sort of whole without making a sort of unified statement about things.
Yeah, right. It did work really well. It did work really well. You mentioned, well, I'll remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Odie Lindsay. The book, We Come to Our Senses, is a collection of short stories, what we're talking about. And you mentioned your mentorship with Barry Hanna, who sounds like a guy who really taught you to go straight into the heart of the matter. That sounded like a kind of an important literary relationship for you, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and what wisdom he imparted to you, and maybe what you pass on to your students from that relationship.
Absolutely, and let me say I had the best of sort of two different ends of the spectrum in terms of working with various writers. I went to graduate school at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and worked with people there, Sarah Levine and some other people who basically said you can make any sort of narrative that you want. In theory, I could hang yarn from a ceiling and have that yarn attached to single words. And if I say this is my novel, they'll accept it. But they are going to critique me and make sure that I can answer, here's why I picked this yarn, these words, these cards, this ceiling, So one thing, it was open to this. And then when I got down to Mississippi and worked with Barry Hanna, he wouldn't have in any of that. And I got both. I got them both. But Barry was incredibly generous. The first tiny piece I ever had published was in a graduate creative writing journal out of University of Mississippi. And I wrote him a letter. And I said, hey, man, I wonder what you would think of this piece. And I was in Chicago and never thought I'd hear back. And about a week and a half later, I see this letter come from B. Hanna. And it was this incredible, generous, supportive, I love this thing. What are you doing? How's your work going? Checking in. I, being a young writer who had no sort of connection or reach to that stratosphere of success, I then wrote him back two or three more times. Every time he would answer, invite me to come down, point me in a direction in terms of professional career, writing or otherwise. And I finally got down there. And the funny thing is that looking back, everyone who worked with the guy had stories about his generosity. He would not pull any punches with you, but he always, I think, even referred to us as colleagues from day one. And when he felt that the writing wasn't as being as direct or as honest as it could be, he would let you know. And one anecdote I'll give you is I remember I turned in something that was pretty. I think it was well put together, but it didn't really have any gut or heart to it. And he just called it cute and handed it back to me. and I sort of doubled down and I remember going home and I was furious and I thought, oh, I want to dive into something. And I was remembering when I was a kid and I listened to a lot of, early 80s punk rock, and I wrote this story called They, which is now in the collection, and I took it back the next week and sort of thrust it at him, and he read it, and said, hey man, come over to my house, and then he came over and he gave me a leather jacket, and he was like, okay, he was like, I don't exactly know what this is, but I feel it, go with that, go towards the complicated truth, and so you could do that with everyone. It could just make you feel cared for. He's incredibly generous, but he also would steer you towards the thing that maybe you wanted to steer away from as a writer. And then it was just lovely. It was incredible.
That's an amazing story. I really enjoyed it. They is a great story.
Thank you. Yeah.
Should all wear a leather jacket. We'll drink a lot of beer while we're
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
He's like, but it's funny when Barry Hanna gives you a leather jacket in order, the symbolic support of your writing, and then asks you if it fits okay, and if not, like, no worries, you don't have to take it. You know, you say,
so
no, it fits. It's perfect. Yeah, I got it.
It's perfect. Yeah, that's fantastic. There are a couple of things that I think are instructive to writers, maybe especially short story writers, but writers in general, and that in your writing. And I think, you know, you have such striking images. I mean, you have like these pictures of aborted fetuses or the ultrasounds taken before they're aborted in these really beautiful silver frames. You have, you know, being helicoptered into war zones analogized to babies in bouncy seats. You have all these tampons in a swimming pool. Like, the images are just really visceral and stick with you. And I'm wondering if there's any wisdom you somehow can impart on kind of either what you collect in your cabinet of curiosities or maybe, you know, juxtaposing really different emotions, like, you know, the image of babies in bouncy seats in war or, you know, I don't know, things not where they belong, like tampons in a swimming pool. Just, I don't know how you come up with these amazing images that I feel like are burned on my brain, you know, for a lifetime now.
Well, I'm sorry for that, but in a way I'm also appreciative. You know, I think one of the other things that it took me a while to figure out, and I'm still figuring out, is that thematically, after you draft and you rewrite and you revise and you tear it up and you go from third person to first and back again, when you establish a sort of series of themes in stories, you just go back and you look for tiny opportunities to play those themes out and help them be unified. And so in the case of these stories, again, I wanted to get into this notion of gender as it relates to combat. I wanted to get into notions of what historically or traditionally it meant to be a male soldier or a female soldier, likewise responsibilities of those traditional sort of heteronormative genders and how that's backed up. Well, that started turning into this notion of femininity. I served with females, and I knew that when I came home, I was always more of a man for having served. And I thought, what about them? What's the traditional role there? What is it if somebody's supposed to, quote-unquote, live up to having kids or nurturing or all of this? What happens if that's taken away? And that played out in Dora. And I guess point being, in swinging it back to my fine-tuning care of themes, is that when people end up in a swimming pool and one of them can't have children because of her condition, the things in the swimming pool they might start off as rocks or trash from a fast food restaurant, but no, they don't. They end up as tampons. They end up initially, in fact, she thinks that they're bundled up blossoms from a magnolia tree. So you have these sort of opportunities to discuss this fertility or infertility or gender and how that plays out. And same thing maybe with babies in bouncer seats. Again, it echoes from start to finish this notion of childhood, of sculpting, of gender, of embodying things, but also of a process of growth at war. You really were when we flew into a spot sitting in these little hammocks, and as I know from my child, I think they called it a Johnny Jump Up when I was a kid, and my child has been in one, but it was very much this sort of baby thing. So it worked as a literal image, but it also worked to carry out thematically this notion of reproduction, and even of recycled sort of culture. Again, it's stemmed from my war tying into the next war, tying into, unfortunately, you know, who knows what's going to happen next. But, so you can tell I can talk, by the way. But I did try to think a lot about that. I actually, and one last thing I'll say is I worked with Bruce and Christine Scott at a writer's conference a while back, and she had this amazing way to frame it. She pictured a sort of sandbox with tools in it, and she said that if you have these tools in your sandbox, and let's say in my case it starts off as gender, fertility, or war culture, or whatever, as you're fine-tuning your stories, don't leave that field or that box with those tools. Use things that relate to those tools throughout, and it just makes everything really come together in a space. So I think that's a key. That's a key to pulling it off.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of these came through the revision process, which is good to know.
For sure. And it was looking for opportunities. Yeah, it absolutely was going back and saying, is this enough? I have an image here or a detailed sort of space. Does that opportunity speak directly to my theme? And if not, is there something I can put in here that does?
Right, right.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is really effective for writers, especially of short stories, is to sort of take two braids of a story. And I'm trying to think off the top of my head which stories in here do this, but I noticed it throughout. Take two storylines that are happening simultaneously and then, you know, rub them up against each other or braid them back and forth, in order to make one storyline more impactful of the other. I think that's, short stories are just so very tricky to write. The endings are so tricky to get. And that does seem like a technique that a few of these stories used, either doing that through backstory with present story or, two character storylines, kind of colliding within the story itself. And again, I don't know if that's conscious on your part or, a device you use from the writerly toolbox or if it just happens organically and you look back over it and say, oh, yeah, that worked.
I'm not good enough to make anything happen organically. now and again, maybe something happens that I say, this makes sense with another story that's in the collection. But invariably, again, it's looking for opportunities. And in fact, Colleen is this character you mentioned in third person. She's a vet of the latest Gulf Wars. She existed. The last story called Hers existed. And there's a female character mentioned in there, and at some point I'm writing Colleen, and I've lived with these stories forever, and I think, well, wait a second. Of course, the female character from the last story, which is from the first Gulf War, should be the mother of Colleen, and maybe that feels, immediate now or too easy, but at the time when you're looking at these separate pieces and you're trying to interconnect them, just almost in the slightest of ways, on paper at least, you look for those opportunities. You look for the chance that if there's a story called EVM at the start and maybe it doesn't immediately fit with the rest of the collection, by the end, EVM is mentioned in another story. Mm. And that, to me, my first love, my first really great influence in life when I was a kid, I grew up outside of San Antonio, Texas in the 70s, was the Willie Nelson album Redheaded Stranger. And it was a concept album, but it had these narratives that overlapped. And then in a literary sense, I loved Spoon River and Winesburg. And I always liked when things just sort of bumped up into each other or if there was this liminal sort of crossover moment. So I looked for opportunities for that to happen. And a couple times it happened organically. Yeah, the rest were just sort of thematic ways to try to have this undergirded structure.
So good. And animals are a great way, I think, to show some form of human emotion in an animal. I mean, they're so symbolic anyway, and they pop up all over these stories, but great way to show kind of unintentioned emotion almost,
I think so, and maybe akin to when you are living or wanting to write about a space that you love, but then for me I had to decide to sort of not love it to have traction. I'm such an animal person. I've got an old dog in the car with me here, Margaret. So I thought, wow, these animals always convey such emotion for me. And I think for so many people, and they serve various purposes here. It breaks my heart in this collection now.
Yeah.
It breaks my heart in this collection. Although it would... Turtle and her boyfriend save turtles. That's good.
That's good.
The thing I do in real life. I love saving turtles on a road. So, do some uplift.
They fared better than the birds, I would say, and the dogs.
They fared better than the birds. Now, this is funny because part of the writing story. So, I was living. It was also in Mississippi. And this flock of cedar waxwings came into my backyard one day, and they ate all the berries. It was just this frenzied activity. And one of them flew over and hit the window, as they want to do, birds, and it fell at my feet dead. And I thought, oh, I've got to start the story. It's got to start with this guy in a backyard and the cedar waxwing falls at his feet. And of course, like the first lines of Pale Fire, or a poem about a cedar waxwing falling dead at someone's feet. And I thought, damn it, I can't do that. So where can I go with this? And I thought, well, wait, birds always, they never get in the house. And so that's why, that bird in particular, had actually been in the house.
Yeah.
Had to land on somebody while they were sleeping. I thought, okay, now this is an opportunity. It's all an opportunity, right? So,
did you know that it's a some myth, superstition, that if a bird flies in your house, someone's going to die? So you don't want
no.
me to. Yes, it is.
No.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Somebody lands on Darla, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. Yeah, it was so good.
I have to. No, poor Darla. Well, no, but that's good to know, because I feed birds outside of my house, so maybe I need to put them further back in the yard.
That's just a superstition. Don't worry about it.
I'm going to worry about it. I'm that guy. I'm going to worry about it all day. At least it was the bird that died, I guess, at least. It was the bird that died.
Right. Hard to know. we're drawing down on our time. We always never have enough time, and I have 30 more questions. But can you leave us with advice? Writing advice through the course of these 15 stories?
Again, I think it's always looking for opportunity, but again, for me, it was just so much revision and so much editing and really falling in love with that process. I am so in love with that process and not settling for what you think is good. And in fact, I'll just anecdotally, I had a wonderful opportunity to work with Tim O'Brien for about a second. And his big thing was make sure that every single syllable is working. And I'd already turned in the final manuscript for this collection. And I called my editor. I said, you know what? Pause on that. Let me look at it one more time. And I bet you I made another 1,000 corrections to sentences or syllables there, just based upon just throwing a new lens on it and saying, you know what, I want to make sure that every single syllable and word and sentence comes together. And again, I've grown to love it. So it's not a labor, it's a joy. And yeah, I think that makes a huge difference.
That serves the writing process so well. I mean, I wish more writers would have that attitude, that people are so quick to publication, they're so quick to get things off their desk and out into the world, and if they would take your advice, please take this advice and make every, especially in a short story, I mean, they're more akin to poems. Everything has to work. And yeah, perfect advice.
Well, and it's the one thing we can control, right? I mean, publication is difficult, but navigating the world is difficult. Whether or not you're going to have a moment for work is difficult. You know, all of these things can come up, but the one thing you can do is control the language itself and learn to fall in love with that process. And so, you know, I just really live for that.
Absolutely. Odie Lindsay, this was such a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great holiday, a great, great Christmas, and stay tuned for more great programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.